Do you know what the difference is between a skiff and a dory? Do you have a drift boat, or are you in the market for a new drift boat and not sure exactly what to get? And have you heard of resin infusion and why this is a huge innovation in the drift boat industry right now? Justin from Adipose Boatworks is back on the podcast to walk us through all of these topics and to give you some drift boat safety tips for the big season. This is the Wet Fly Swing Podcast, where I show you the best places to travel to for fly fishing, how to find the best resources and tools to prepare for that big trip, and what you can do to give back to the fish species we all love. Hey, I'm Dave, host of the Wet Fly Swing Podcast. I've been fly fishing since I was a little kid. I grew up in a little fly shop and have created one of the largest fly fishing podcasts in this country. I've also interviewed more of the greatest fly anglers than just about anyone in the world. Today, Justin Weyenberg is here to describe how resin infusion has allowed them to make a more durable and lighter drift boat skiff. He's going to tell us two huge reasons you might need a skiff and why the Missouri River might be under the radar and how you can fit this in this year for success on a big trip. Plus, you're going to get Justin's top choices for food and drinks if you're heading through the area this year. Justin's got a lot going on at Adipose, so this is going to be an awesome episode. You know, I always get a little freakish with drift boats, so let's get back into it. Here we go. Justin Weyenberg from AdiposeBoatworks.com. How you doing, Justin?
Good, Dave. It's good to be chatting again after craziness of last time we talked was peak COVID, and the world has changed a lot since then.
Yeah, that's right. It was peak COVID. It was episode 187, and that was, a few years ago. We've kind of put that behind us for the most part, but you guys survived it. What did you guys see with the, selling boats during that time? Did things get a little bit busier for you?
Yeah, it's definitely changed the landscape. I think, like you said, we kind of put the actual disease behind us, but I think we're always going to be impacted in the outdoor space by it and kind of look back at this time and be like, that was pretty nuts. I'm seeing it level back out. It's definitely, in some ways, I've talked to other people in the industry too, and we've had to reset my brain to like, okay, what did the winter of 2019 look like? And then kind of go from there, because we just had this crazy growth where you'd get a used boat in and sell immediately, and you never had to try to sell new boats or anything like that. And now it's like, we're starting to have to put in a little bit more legwork and stuff, but the times they're still good. And I think that just with the West growing and the Rocky Mountain states really getting the influx of people still, you build a house in Bozeman and you got to put a drift boat in the garage. So
That's right. Yeah, they're out there. That's awesome. And maybe for those that didn't hear that episode, it was back, I think it published in February. So basically 2021, 3 years ago, but maybe give an update quick on Adipose. Like, what is, you guys, obviously your name is out there a lot. I hear a lot about you, throughout the years and stuff. But what is it that makes you guys maybe a little bit different than some of the other brands out there?
Yeah, this is the perfect time to be having this chat again. So pretty much like right around the time that we last talked, we've been keeping it under wraps for a long time. But Adipose has always built its name on just being the highest of quality, like offering the best of the best. Like, we're not trying to compete with the cheapest models. We're not trying to be the middle of the road. We're trying to be that Sims or that Patagonia or that Orvis range in the market, whatever you want to look at it. And there's a technology that's been out there for a long time. It's called resin infusion. Some people know it as vacuum bagging. There's a couple different techniques to it, but we've been researching this for the last 3 years, doing some R&D, just trying to figure out a good way to implement this into our production. And after the last 3 years of R&D, we finally were confident enough to be able to launch into it. So this last March, March of 2023, we went into full production or offered it in production. And then over the following 7 months, we kind of finished up boats that we had sold prior that were the traditional way into this new resin infusion way. And now 2024 on, every single boat we make is going to be resin infused. And just to give you a very quick mile high view of that. So traditionally, everyone in the drift boat world has been building boats the same way, where in the fiberglass world, I should say, where you have an open mold and you spray your gel coat in whatever color the boat's going to be. So let's say it's going to be blue. You spray the blue gel coat in, and then you use this thing called the chopper gun. The chopper gun sprays out resin, catalyst that mix together in the tip, and then also you have a chop strand mat that comes down through like a big ball of fiberglass, gets chopped up at the gun, and you spray that down, and then you wet out some fabrics, and as you wet it out, you build all your layers one at a time and just wet them out as you go. Imagine like you're laying down paper towels and then spraying water on top of it, or spraying water down and then laying with paper towels to soak it up. So that's how traditionally all the hulls have been made. It works great. There's really not a lot wrong with it. The problems that you run into is if you don't get the correct amount of resin, then you're going to get dry spots. If you get too much resin, then it's going to become oversaturated, which is going to become brittle. And then also excess resin causes excess weight. And in the drift boat world, obviously weight is a huge deal. And not to pat ourselves on the back too hard, but we were really good at it. I had some really good guys that were building our boats that even when we're good, like we're probably getting like a maybe a 50-50, most likely a 60-40, where it's like 60% resin, 40% fabric. And then if we're doing it really good, which most of the time we were, we'd get 50-50, 50% resin, 50% fabric. So with this new way, what you do is you lay all, you do the same first steps the same. So you paint your whole blue. Then you lay all your fabrics in there dry, one at a time, just kind of sticking them on top of each other. There's a little bit of a spray adhesive that holds them in place, but for the most part, it's just a straight dry layup. Once you're done, in simplest terms, you take a big plastic bag, you pull this plastic bag up and over the mold, and then you use this stuff called tacky tape. It's like almost like a clay double-sided tape, and so it's about a half inch wide by eighth inch thick, and you stick that all the way around the flange of your mold. And then once you do that, you stick this plastic bag to it. On one end, you have a hose that goes out into a vacuum. And then on the other end, you essentially have a, once you suck all that air down, you pull all the air out of the in between the cavity and the plastic bag. So it's crushing all your fabrics down to an extreme amount of pressure. At our altitude, because it all depends on where you're at our altitude, we're getting about 27 to 28 pounds of pressure per inch. So essentially, we've created a vacuum chamber. The only thing inside that chamber is our fabrics and our cores. So once you've done that, you actually plumb in some lines that are going to be that you pinch them off so you don't obviously lose your vacuum, and then you stick those lines down into a just a 5 gallon bucket of resin. Once you stick those lines down in there, then you just open it up, and the vacuum on the one end and the lines on the other, it just feeds all your resin down into that vacuum, and that's the only thing that can go in there. So any little bit of air that was in there is now being replaced with resin. And so it feeds out. We kind of have to do it in a specific way. So it fish bones and kind of goes to everywhere equally. And once it's done, you just clip off your lines, let it cure, and then you peel off the plastic bag, throw that away, and throw away some other consumables and stuff. But you have a vacuum infused hull that is way stronger, way stiffer, way more durable, and quite a bit lighter than a traditional laid hull.
Wow, yeah, that's it. And that's the resin infusion is that kind of that big, well, I guess the whole thing, but that last step where you're the resin's going in and it's basically sucking out all of the air, essentially. So is that kind of the difference between that and, say, another boat that used an older method? There'd be a lot more air spaces in there in the fiberglass?
Yeah, definitely. There's going to be more air. And you just got to imagine, like, if you just make like a circle with your index finger and your thumb, like, that's about a square inch right there. So imagine that spread across the full, like, stack those one on next to each other across the whole square footage of the boat. Now that much pressure has crushed all those fabrics into one essentially seamless, even though there is different layers to it, hull. And then trying to imagine that same amount of pressure and consistency in a normal layup, we actually had to, in our R&D and stuff, one of the big things that we ran into was I was really worried about punching a hole in the boat, because this process, like everything that we do, starts with NASA and aerospace, right? So it's been used in fighter jets, it's been used in airplanes, it's been used in racing yachts, it's been used in F1 cars, and all that technology and developments where we were able to get our hands on this, it just had to become cheap enough for us to be able to justify it. And just like back in the day when a flat screen TV was $4,000, now you can buy one for $400. It's the same thing. It's just had to get to a point where we could justify it. And so by doing all that, we actually had to increase the weights of our fabrics, because everything that we use is kind of weighed out by a square footage, or a square meter, I should say. And so because that was so much more compressed, it made the hole actually thinner. And because this isn't an F1 car that just needs to be stiff and go around corners, it needs to actually be able to take the impacts.
Right. Hit rocks and stuff, right? Occasionally.
Yeah, totally. Like, if people are always like, oh man, you guys should make a boat out of carbon fiber. And it's like, yeah, carbon fiber in theory is a great product, but carbon fiber is just made to be stiff and had some flex to it. But if you've ever seen an F1 crash, like, those things explode.
That's right.
Well, that's what we do not want, is we want it to be able to take that abrasion and that impact day after day after day and continue on rocking and not have leaking and not have separation and stuff. And so we were using similar fabrics and we're using similar resins. That's the biggest thing we switched, is our resins in this process. We're not using just an open molded resin. We're using an actual vinyl ester type resin, which has better properties for elongation and impact and all those things. But yeah, so that was one of the big things. So we actually increased our fabric by over 30%, close to 35% of fabric weight that we increased, but we decreased the overall weight of the boat by 50 pounds. Oh, wow. Which is huge in the drift boat world. There's a lot of misnumbers out there on what a hole weighs and what a boat weighs and yada yada, but our fully rigged out drift boat, seats, oarlocks, all of it is at 390 pounds now. And I'm confident to say that we are the first major drift boat company that has a 15 foot hull that weighs less than 400 pounds.
Right. So you guys are under the 400 pound, and it's like you said, and it's actually a more durable boat than what you guys had before. Is that's the case too?
Yeah, definitely. And so, and that's what I've been seeing this last year. Like, we had boats that we tested for over a year out in the field and stuff, and had them in different areas and tried them on different things and stuff. And one of the big things that I'm most impressed with is when these boats hit a rock, it's like, before you'd kind of see like a weird type fray to it almost. And now it's just like, you still get the gel coat. It's just gel coat. Like, there's nothing you can do about it where it's going to chip. It's going to show some glass underneath. But when it does get into that glass, like, the amount of abrasion and just impact resistance that these boats are having is pretty impressive.
Amazing. Cool. Well, I'm glad you started with that, because that is a big, you know, innovation, right? I mean, that sounds awesome. But take us back real quick on, for those that hadn't, you know, listened to 187, on Adipose. Maybe the skiff, I think, is that still the main thing you guys are doing? Or talk about like maybe what the skiff is and some of your models and what you have going there.
Yeah, so we have three different models. Two of them are our main sellers. Our flagship is what we call our Flow Skiff, and that's definitely still our most popular model. That boat originally came from just the necessity of these Western Rocky Mountain rivers that aren't quite on the front. They're more in the plains lands and still in the front too, but they're not designed to be rowing class three rapids every day and going through huge, huge wave trains and stuff. What they are is they're the rivers that we're fishing out here. And really I've found all across the country that everyone's running into is just, especially with the things, the way that things are trending, is low, shallow water and windy rivers. But also a huge portion of people are going out with three people, whether they're guides or just buddies. They've gone in on a boat together. They all just get together and they're weekend warriors, however you want to break it down. But so it needs to be able to hold three people comfortably with all your gear, but it also needs to be able to draft in sub 6 inches of water. And it needs to be able to handle that upriver, downriver, side river, 25 mile an hour winds that we just constantly run into. And so that's kind of where that skiff design was born out of. And that's what we have taken and turned into kind of a hybrid design of a traditional dory, which when someone thinks drift boat, a lot of times they just think like dory designs, which we've talked about in the past, big pointy bow, a lot of rocker, really narrow in the back and stuff. Those boats definitely have their place, I know. And one of the people you talked to in that series was guys going to the Grand Canyon and stuff. And so, yeah, that's definitely has a place, and those boats are amazing for that. But you can't really have the Swiss Army knife in the drift boat world. You got to kind of narrow it down to where are you going to spend most of your time? What are you going to be chasing most of the time? And so that's where that skiff design came from. And so what we did is we took out a lot of that rocker front to back, just kind of made it the flatter profile. And then we cut off that big pointy bow. We blunted up the front. We widened up the back. And then we widened up the middle too. So it just makes an extremely stable platform that drafts a little bit of water. It's easy to move around in. It's easy to maneuver. It's easy to get in and out of. And just all the things. It's easy to see around in and stuff. For the types of rivers that you're going to be fishing in. Again, like I've spent a lot of time in Michigan. I've spent time on the East Coast in North Carolina, Tennessee, all the way up and down from Maine to Georgia. We have these boats, same thing on the West Coast, Washington to California, and then speckled everywhere in between, Oklahoma, you name it. We have boats and guys are loving them there for that aspect. And then two, kind of touch those other areas that we talked about where it's going to be bigger water. We do offer our runoff design, and that's just a little bit bigger bow, a little bit more meat and potatoes up in the front to handle those big wave trains, run that class three rapids, but still be fishable and maneuverable, different than like, again, a traditional dory, because dory, I would say, in my opinion, isn't made to really fish out of. It's made to just run big rapids and kind of go from spot to spot. And so that's where that runoff kind of fills that niche there.
Want to experience a magic trick? On a certain river at a certain time of day, time slows down. Where is this place? Located in the heart of Montana is a place where people go to slow things down, to float down a historic river, and to watch the birds dance across the sky. Watch animals explore the open land, and of course, to fish. If you're looking to slow things down, Helena, Montana is waiting for you. Visit Helena, Montana right now. You can head over to HelenaMT.com to get a change of pace this year. Did you say you had a third model out there too?
Yep. And so that third model that we have, it's the South Fork Skiff. That boat's been around for a very long time. Adipose started in 2009. South Fork was started back in the late 80s in Jackson Hole. and we just bought the rights to that boat. That boat is a very traditional skiff. When you think skiff, that's it. It's got a flat bow, which a flat bow is also referred to as a pram. And so it's got that pram bow. It's got really low sides. It does work for three people, but in my opinion, that's really a two-man boat, two-angler boat. And so with a two-angler boat, you're running a little bit less gear, couple less rods and stuff. It still handles bigger water great. Like, I'm not going to say it runs threes or anything, but it definitely will handle a lot of the stuff on the Snake and where it was designed to be used and stuff. And so that boat, not a big seller for us, but the people who know, and they love it. And it's got its cult following, and the South Fork skiff people are self-admitted prima donnas. So they bring their own personality with it. And but that's one that we love to be able to offer and have in our repertoire, because it's personally for my style of fishing. When I go out in a drift boat and like how I fish, I don't guide. I go out with my kid or my girlfriend or whoever, like that couple buddies or a buddy. Like, that's the boat that I use. I love the South Fork skiff for that.
Yeah, that was a great explanation, I think, on the skiff. So you guys don't do a traditional style like dory boat at all?
No, we don't. I don't. Honestly, I just don't find the need for them anymore. Like, I think that we talked about, I think people can go back and listen to that episode and get a real more in-depth view on that. And go listen to the other ones, too. I think you talked to Boulder Boatworks. I think you talked to some people that have some really traditional designs. And they believe they have their beliefs and their reasons why they do it. And their customers love them and stuff. To me, at the end of the day, like, I don't really care what boat you row, as long as you're happy, as long as you're out on the river and wanting to protect it and showing some river etiquette, then I think more power to you.
Perfect, perfect. So, and I just want to go back again, the difference between the skiff. So you mentioned the flow skiff, the runoff skiff, and then the South Fork. So the South Fork, you said, is kind of more like a pram. So talk about that blunt, like the front. How does the South Fork skiff differ than, say, the flow as far as that front end, the bow of the boat?
So the flow and the runoff have what we would call like a three-point front, where, again, like a traditional design just is one continuous swoop up to the front of and creates that knife edge point. And so the flow and the runoff, they have that same curve, but then at the very last, they kind of both take a sharp cut towards the middle to create that point. And so it still is a traditional, there's a point there, but it's not a knife edge point. And so again, like back to just real quick, why we don't believe that you need that design, because instead of knifing into big waves, you're going to hit those waves and get a little bit more buoyancy out of it. You're not going to stab as deep in and get that big rocking action as you come out of them and stuff. But it's nice to have something to at least force that water to the sides with that design. And then a pram and the South Fork skiff, that's just a straight up like boom. Like, it does the same thing. It kind of slightly curves to the front. Once it gets to the front, it just cuts straight across 90 degrees. And again, that works fine. A couple things, like, we're always looking at how the wind is affecting the boat and stuff. So we think that a flat bow is going to catch a little bit more wind versus breaking it around aerodynamics wise and stuff. And then a big one is just coming into those waves with a traditional pram design, traditional skiff design. You really don't want to come like straight into a wave. You honestly want to like almost like, I wouldn't say as drastic as a 45, but like give yourself like 20 or 30 degrees just so that that corner does
you're cutting it.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's always ways to get around it and stuff, but that's just why, again, like when we came up with that flow design and the runoff design, essentially we just made a bigger flow to make the runoff. But when we came up with those designs, all we did was just, we took the best of both worlds, where it's like, okay, the skiffs row great, they perform great in the wind and stuff. The dories, they do great in the waves and they can spin easy. So let's combine those two and make this design.
That's it. That makes sense. Yeah, I got you. Okay, so it's a you have a little bit of a point up front on the flow, and that it's just not completely flat, and it looks definitely different. So there's that. And then as far as the, you know, I know I've heard stories from boats out there, plenty of people taking these boats, skiffs through like whitewater, you know, so I think they can do it. But like anything, you know, even I've had a big dory in whitewater and swamped it before and almost sunk a boat, you know, so anybody can make a mistake. I think it doesn't matter. But are guys taking these skiffs down on like multi-day trips out in your neck of the woods? Like, can they put some gear on there and do that sort of thing? Or is this more like more day stuff?
Oh, no, absolutely. Yeah, that's, again, like just kind of how we talked about where the South Park's a great like two-person, couple-day, like minimalist boat. But with the flow and just being realistic about it, where you're going to use it. We have guides that, very popular river in Montana for multi-day floats is the Smith River. And so we have guides that, and regular Joe Schmoes, that are taking these boats down the Smith multiple times a year. And so I have a couple boats out there that have probably been down the Smith over 100 times, probably close to 200 times, depending.
And there's whitewater. There's whitewater in the Smith, a little bit.
Yeah, Montana whitewater. There's,
yeah. three, somewhere in the three or like that. Yeah, that rough. Yeah,
touching through. Like, I don't think many people in Montana have actually seen a real class three in Idaho and in certain spots. But yeah, there's that. I definitely wouldn't take down Grand Canyon or stuff like that. But if there's obviously, there's plenty of room for it. And that's one of the great things, again, not to just beat on the design, but with that traditional dory football shape, you lose so much space in the front and you lose so much space in the back because the boat gets so narrow that you can't do anything with it. And the way that we blunted it up and made it more angular separation, made just more room in the middle throughout the boat. There's so much room in these boats that you can put a lot more gear in there. Like, we have a designated spot for our cooler, which sounds dumb to say, but you'd be very surprised on like how many of these boats just like don't have a good spot for a cooler that's centered up and whatnot. And so you can fit actually a Yeti 110 in the front of the boat, but most guys are running like a 65 quart cooler or whatever. And there's that. And then behind the rear angler, there's a decent amount of spot. Our dry storage compartments are on the side, have a ton of space. So yeah, I've talked to guys that have taken these boats down the Smith. They've taken them down the Flathead for multi-day floats, and really just anywhere that you would want to, that you can take a hard boat.
Yeah, that's the thing with it, because I mean, it sounds like because of the how wide they are, and I'm not sure on the exact specifics on the width and stuff, but they can hold weight, right? That's the thing with these boats. You can put quite a bit of weight in them. Would it be similar to, I mean, the lower sides, you know, you have lower sides, but yeah, I mean, you can load these things up with three guys and some gear for a two-day trip, like no problem.
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah. No, most drift boats are going to be 56 inches wide at the bottom, and then like roughly 74 to 77 at the beam, and we're 58 at the bottom and we're 74 at the beam. But that 2 inches makes a huge difference, along with, if you just imagine that 2 inches running the full length of that boat, and then also how much of that is going to be in the water and without as much rocker and stuff. And then also we do, to an extent, compared to some boats, we have lower sides, but compared to like the more popular boats that you're going to see in our area, we actually have taller sides because we don't have that traditional like big recurve design that you'd see where it like goes from a big pointy bow, drops down a ton, rises up drastically at the oarlocks, and then drops back down. And we don't have as much of that. We still have a rise at the oarlocks just to get our blocks above the gunwale, but it's all
higher.
Yeah, so when you put two boats side by side, they're going to be, and especially with how much little less water we draft than those other models, it's going to fit in there nice and handle water and gear and all that stuff.
That makes sense. Nice. So I think we touched on that pretty well as far as the, you know, the skiff versus, and like, you know, the dory, and we did a whole season on that with a bunch of different, so we'll have some links in the show notes to that. I noticed a couple other things out there. First, one thing was, I do see out there on social, you know, with your kid fishing. Like, what's your home water? What's the river you're fishing if you got some time to head out?
I have ADD, so yeah. I'm kind of all over the place, and I'm blessed in my job where I work 9 to 5, and so I get my weekends off, and I'm able to do what I'd like. So I'm all over the place. Like, if I'm just going to shoot out and fish for an afternoon or after work or something, I'm definitely going to go hit the Missouri. The Missouri that's a very broad term also.
It's a big river. It's a giant river, right?
Yeah. So when I say I fish the Missouri, that means I'm going all the way from Tustin and Three Forks area down to Fort Peck and to the North Dakota border. And you can run into everything from world-class dry fly fishing there with size 20 tricos, or you can throw big pike flies and small little carp flies and chase whatever you'd like in between there. And but my kid, like, yeah, if it's up to her, she's going to do whatever we can where she can jump off the boat and swim and kind of just make the day of that, picking up rocks and do whatever. So the Missouri is definitely a big one for us. That's one thing I love about Helena, though, to be honest, is that it's a great hub. So if you just stick a pin in the middle of Helena and then you draw a circle of where can I get in 2 hours? And for me, like, and to some people, but out here in Montana, we blink and we drive 2 hours. It's pretty easy to get a good distance in that amount of time and stuff. And so, honestly, I can fish the Blackfoot. I can fish the Big Hole. I can fish the Yellowstone. I can fish the Madison. I can fish the Missouri. I can even make it as far as the Flathead in some areas, the Clark Fork, the Bitterroot. And so all those rivers are within 2 hours of us. And so being spoiled as we are, as I am, you just look at the weather, you decide which species you want to chase that day and which technique you want to use, and you point the truck that way and just go. And so, yeah, it's kind of all over. But obviously, Missouri holds a special place with just the big fish under ice and the technicality of that and the ease of it. But hitting up those smaller freestones and getting out even walk wading and doing some of that is pretty cool, too.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, you guys are. That's a good way to put it. Just put a, you know, right in the middle. The Helena is kind of right in the middle of all these other names you hear about, right? You just mentioned the rivers and stuff. So, and then what is on the Missouri? Maybe talk about that. Are there some, I'm sure there's people guiding the Missouri. Are there any shops, you know, locally or any people that you'd recommend that are guiding the Missouri? Have you been out with anybody out there?
Yeah, pretty much all the shops up and down the Missouri are great shops. The two that I spend the most time with and have worked the most with is Headhunters and Craig and Trout Montana and Cascade. Those two shops are definitely outfitted some of the best in honestly the country, but this area where they're going to have the most amount of knowledge for what's happening on the river that day. And then they're going to have the bug selection for that, and they're going to share that knowledge with you openly. A lot of shops get a bad name of, like, come in there, they're kind of stuffy and don't want to talk to you or whatever, but both those shops do a good job. And then in Helena, we have Montana Fly Goods. They're great, too, for if you're going to hit any of the reservoirs and even the rivers or whatever, they do a great job. And then if you're just looking for right off the interstate, too, which everything's right off the interstate along that river, but the Wolf Creek Angler. So Wolf Creek Angler, Headhunters, Trout Montana, and Montana Fly Goods, those four shops are going to get you everything you need on all levels. And they all have great guides that work for them. They're running big staff. If you're on social media, you should definitely follow Headhunters and check out Mark Reisler's. He's one of the owners there. His river reports and daily updates, he's just a character. Even if you don't ever want to go fish the river, just go listen to him talk about it.
Yeah, good. Yeah, we'll put those in the show notes as well. And this is good. So we got some good firepower here. So if we were let's just keep it on the Missouri. I know you're all over the place, but if we were to putting together a trip, what's your recommendation on, you know, to find a good time for the Missouri? I know it's huge, but, you know, where do you start there? I guess we could call the shops, but what do you think is a good time, a good section to hit?
Oh, man, it's all just dependent on the time of year. Like, if you're going to be here in early spring, like, what's a couple of my, the great thing about the Missouri, if people don't know, is it's a giant tailwater. And so when people talk about the Missouri for trout fishing, that's going to be from Holter Reservoir down to Cascade. That's the Missouri, which is 36 miles of river. All the way up and down the river is easily accessible ramps. They're very good marked. They're shuttle services. Each one of those shops that I mentioned, besides Montana Fly Goods, are going to do shuttles for you. And they'll give you recommendations. But, like, to me, it's gotten, and I'm not, like, down-talking at all. The river's obviously gotten more crowded and stuff in the last handful of years. But the shoulder seasons used to be, like, amazing because no one was there. Now it doesn't seem like there's as much of a shoulder season. But I really like that early stuff, like April time frame before, and I'm not talking like going up to the dam and raping reds and doing that deal.
All right.
I'm talking about like getting on the river when those betas start coming off and you get some blue wings going early in the season. That water temp climbs back up into the high 40s, low 50s, and you'll get some amazing dry fly hatches in that early season. You got to be a little bit tougher soul to be out there that time of year.
Yeah. Month-wise, what's the early season? What would that be early? What would be early?
April. So you're going to be like mid-April to late April in there. And I would not recommend going up by the dam at that time. That's where everyone else is going to tell you to go because it's just that's where there's a million. There's roughly 3,500 fish per mile there, I believe.
Right.
The average size is 16 to 17 inches, I think, is the average size. So there's a lot of them going to be stacked up there pre-spawn, getting ready or spawning or whatever. But you get down in those mid sections, lower river sections, and you're going to have some amazing dry fly fishing. You're not going to see as many people. You're not going to be herding those fish on reds and stuff. So I like that. And then streamer fishing is really good then too. If you're just looking to throw some bigger and big stuff doesn't work that often, on the Missouri, but some bigger streamers and then just kind of be a little bit more aggressive with it. And then that kind of, right, like you can go out there today. I don't know when this is going to launch, but we're talking today, February 19th. Like you honestly could go out there today and catch 100 fish easily.
Oh, you could. So right now, sure, with the right conditions, you can just go ham.
As long as you're brave enough to be out there, the Missouri fish is 365. And right now it's going to obviously be nymphing and swinging some of those deeper, slower holes.
Yeah. What is the temp there right now today? What's it going to be? What's the high?
I'll have to check real quick, but I'm going to guess it's going to be in the low double digits. That's what it's been. Oh, today's not going to be. Yeah. Today actually would not be a horrible day towards the end of the day. It's 21 degrees right now. It's probably going to climb up to 38. 38's my threshold.
And at 38, the cool thing about it is it could be a clear day, which wouldn't be too bad, 38 and clear.
Yeah, we have, like, there's some fog, some overcast right now. Like, up on Craig right now, looking on Weather Underground, it's 29 degrees there right now, 6-mile-an-hour winds, and it's going to be high at 42. Like, if I was 10 years younger, I would have definitely gone out there today, but now and where I'm at in my life, I've caught enough trout. I don't need to be breaking ice off my guides every day, or every cast. But honestly, too, if you like two-handed and you like swinging, that's a great time to be up there. And especially talk to headhunters for that. Those guys are really into that two-handed game and stuff. And so that's a really fun thing to go do this time of year. And then as the season goes on, we have every major hatch that you can think of in the West. We don't, obviously, as a tailwater, you don't get like the squallows and the salmon flies, but you get PMDs, you get trichos, you get the obviously big terrestrials. There's a couple, I'm not going to say you get drakes, but there's, you get caddis. Caddis is like, Caddis starts in April, May, and Caddis carries all the way into October. Huge there. And then, yeah, once you get into the summer, July on until honestly like October, November, the weeds get pretty bad where I wouldn't be out there. You definitely can't be swinging that time of year, and streamers gets a little bit tougher, and even nymphing can get tough, but it's just an incubator, man. The hatch is there, prolific, and it's pretty amazing to see some of that stuff in the morning when during trico season, where it just looks like clouds or plumes of smoke coming up from the shoreline, and it's just up and down the banks covered with them and stuff. And so you can get out there super early and get the initial hatch, or you can go out there a tiny bit later and then get the duns. It's yep, a good,
you got it all.
Yeah.
So it seems like, you know, just from an outsider, you know, I've been around there, you know, the Montana quite a bit, but I mean, the Missouri is the one that maybe doesn't have, well, it has a big name, but you know, you hear about some of these other ones quite a bit more, it seems like. Why do you think that is, or am I wrong on that? Well, why is the Missouri, and everything is kind of connected, a lot of it's connected to the Missouri, right? Is it just because it's the giant river, or why do you think that is?
Honestly, I'm going to say it's because of the size of the towns.
Oh, yeah.
Like, in location to the national parks, right? So, Bozeman is stone's throw away from Yellowstone, and then Yellowstone, the national park, and then obviously the Yellowstone, the river, and then the Madison, and that. And so, that's a big part of it. Obviously, Bozeman has the college, has all that going on with it. And then same thing with Missoula. Missoula is college, river runs through it.
River runs through it, right.
And then also like Glacier, that's when you get up into the Flathead and that stuff. The Missouri's kind of, I'm not going to say it's in no man's land by any means, but it's in betweens.
Yeah, it's in between. What about Great Falls? It's kind of south of Great. What's Great Falls like? Are there some opportunities up there?
Yeah, Great Falls. So when I talked about that first 36 miles of river, that's kind of Cascades, like halfway in between Great Falls and Helena. And then from Cascade down, it honestly turns into a warm water fishery for the most part.
Oh, it does. That's where the pike are.
Yeah, some pike and then mostly carp, some goldeye, just water. And those fish will migrate back and forth different times a year, slide back in the winter. And then also it just, the river really changes down there because like this year has been a pretty mellow winter, but the river will freeze solid down there. And then
oh, wow,
you'll get like huge ice jams and it will just scour that whole river down there. And so it changes. You'll get the bank erosions way worse down there. There's just a lot of factors to it that cause it to be different. Great Falls, it's got an Air Force base on it. It's just different. I like Great Falls, but it's definitely not most people's cup of tea. And then, yeah, just kind of, I think Butte and Helena, just kind of in Great Falls, this I-15 corridor, we kind of just fly under the radar a little bit, which is fine with me. As I'm sitting here talking it up, but
totally, and all the way down to Idaho Falls, right? You stay on 15, it takes you right into the Henry's Fork, right, straight down there.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and so it's just kind of a different feeling through here versus like just west of Helena. Well, like I'm essentially looking at the Continental Divide. You go over the pass, and you just something about that. Like when you cross over that pass, it's just the atmosphere, just everything about the climate feels different over there for some reason. And then as you go east of here, you really, we're where the plains meets the Rockies, in my opinion. And that's where, like, just down river, just north of us, they call it the Gates of the Mountain, where Lewis and Clark came through. And they wrote in their journal, and that's why they call it that. It's like at one portion when they came around a corner, it looked like gates were opening up, and that's where Meriwether Lewis wrote in his journal and said this is the Gates of the Rockies is kind of coming into that, because everything else before here was just straight plains country.
Yeah, that's it. Wow. So yeah, you're in this really cool place, and kind of a, it sounds like a transitional zone, and you're on this giant river which has a tailwater and sounds like amazing fishing. So
yeah, and then the all the reservoirs have really good fishing too. Like there, we in Montana, we don't stock any of our rivers. We stopped that way back in the, I'm gonna sound dumb here, but
a while ago,
thirties, forties.
Oh wow, a long time ago.
Long time ago, something like that. And but we still stock some of our reservoirs. So the reservoirs will have some really big stockers in them, and then obviously you get some spillover into the rivers and different spots. But you can have stillwater fishing, you can have freestone fishing, you can have the tailwater fishing, you can have walkway stuff. It's kind of all mixed in there for different opportunities.
Good. Awesome. Well, I think we've touched on that pretty well there. And I want to take us out of here. We talked a little bit about Helena, but this is kind of our Helena shout out segment. We're going to pick your brain a little bit on some, you know, some local places to hit up as we're, you know, thinking about heading there. But before we get there, I want to talk, are you still doing the drift boat like clinic? Is that something, the 101 drift boat? Are you guys doing that thing out there?
Yes, we are. Our clinic this year is going to be April 27th.
Oh, perfect.
So we do that in conjunction with a veterans organization that's actually based out of Helena here called Mending Waters Montana. Great organization. They take vets out on fishing trips. They do rod building, fly tying. They do overnights. They do day trips. We have access to some really cool private water. And then obviously, like we've been talking about, we do a couple trips on the Missouri, we do trips in Idaho, different spots like that. But that clinic is a great place to just learn all things drift boats. I'm the main presenter there, and we talk about just different drift boat designs. We go over everything from like I just mentioned, like where different drift boats are, why they're different, and then everything from hooking up the boat to launching the boat to loading the boat. So how to row to catch fish.
What about backing up the trailer for somebody new backing up a trailer?
we talked a little bit about that. I give a couple funny stories.
That's not an easy thing to teach, is it?
No. And I'll just say this out here too. I've been on a few boat ramps where people are trying to learn in peak season, peak business. And
that's rough.
To me, there's plenty of empty walnut parking lots across the country.
Yeah, don't. That's not your place to be learning to back up a boat is during peak season.
Yeah, so we do all that. And really, it's all about just how to be safe out there and like where not to drop an anchor, because that's where people get themselves a ton of trouble. And then also just how to stay calm. And like you talked about, where if you want to take, like, I'll say this, I've never seen a drift boat sunk pointing downriver. So if you get in a big wave train, point the bow and go. Like you might swap it, you might take on some water, but as long as you're keeping that thing north to south, you'll be good. But when you start to turn it sideways and drop anchors and do whatever, that's when you're going to get yourself in trouble. And that clinic's free. Ask for donation to Many Waters, but if you're interested in that, shoot me an email at adiposeboatworks@gmail.com, and I'll get your name on the list. It's in Craig. We do it right at the Craig Boat Ramp. We do it at Isaac's there, the restaurant in Craig, which is always nice of them to let us use their parking lot in the morning. And then it's a full day thing. We end the day with a group float. So you get dry land instruction. You get on the water one-on-one instruction, and then we do a group float with everyone and try to have a certified or experienced instructor in every boat at the end of the day doing that. So
perfect. Awesome. We'll put a link out to that. And then you talked to safety a little bit. So give us a few safety tips. Maybe what would be your biggest ones if somebody's at that drift boat clinic? What are you telling them to stay safe? Maybe you mentioned the anchor. Are there a few things that might help somebody keep their boat upright this year?
Yeah, so the biggest thing that I see is, I can't put my finger on where it comes from, but everyone's instinct is to push, right? I don't know if it's from whitewater experience, or I don't know if it's from kayaks or canoes or whatever, where they want to just push forward. But when you push forward, that eats up so much water so much faster. So always, no matter what, just constantly pull. I say it 1,000 times that day is pull. So as long as you're pulling towards yourself. You're constantly slowing yourself down. And when you're slowing yourself down, you're giving yourself more time to react. So if there's a rock or a bridge piling or whatever, another person, whatever in front of you, point your nose at it and pull away from it, and you'll go away from it. Like, that's just how it works, is point and pull. And you got to give yourself a little bit of an angle. So kind of shift one way or the other, and then pull, and the way the chines and the boat works, it's going to cut that edge, just like you're carving, whether you're wakeboarding or snowboarding or skiing or whatever. And it's going to pull you away from that by carving into that water. So always pull. And then the other big part is, just in general, is never tie a knot in your rope. That's a big thing that people like to do, just because they're so scared about losing their anchor rope that they're like, I'm going to tie a knot in this. But if you get in a situation when, whether the boat's anchored and it starts to whip viciously side to side on you, because that's, you got to imagine, right? That anchor's pulling the back of the boat down. And so it starts to whip side to side. All it takes is one lean in too far one way, and all of a sudden that back of that boat sucks and goes down. It's way easier at that point just to let your anchor rope go. Anchor, yeah, it costs $200. Rope costs $40. $240 is way less than $15,000 or $20,000 for a boat and your life.
Yeah, I hear you. Wow, so you're saying, yeah, and there's all sorts of different anchor types of, you know, cleats and all that stuff, but basically don't tie it down. Just let it, if you had to, then you just open up your cleat and it's gone.
The traditional boat that you're going to see has a floor release anchor, and people are like, oh, I keep a knife right here or whatever. No, just if you get in a hairy spot and things get weird, don't do this if you get worried. But if you're on anchor and that boat gets weird, just slam your foot down on that and just let the rope go. The boat will go down. You'll be fine. And then also the other thing, which I was kind of mentioning there, is that a lot of people, when the boat gets sideways or gets weird or gets in some rapids and they get scared, they're like, I need to stop this. And so their instinct is to just slam the anchor down, and then they think that that's just going to stop it. But that's where that anchor will get lodged. It will just rip the whole boat down, and it will get, again, it will cause issues. That happened, sadly, a handful of years ago. Guy on the Missouri, same thing, kind of ran through some side channel with some crazy rapids. Three guys in the boat. The boat got sideways. Guy got scared, slammed his foot down. The boat, the anchor grabbed, yanked the boat straight, sunk immediately. And then two guys were able to get away. The third guy, as the boat sunk, it pulled him down with it, and he got stuck and ended up drowned. Jeez. And yeah, so just things like that where it's like, don't drop anchor in fast water. Always roll over to the side. Normally, whatever the river bank looks like, the first few feet of the water is going to look the same. So if you go up against a hard bank and there's a bunch of riffraff on it or just big boulders, like, don't drop right there, because that anchor is going to get lodged down in those rocks and you're not going to be able to get it out. So I always recommend where you can see the bottom of the river and see what you're going to be anchoring in, and then drop it in some softer current. There's an eddy somewhere, even if you got to row a couple hundred yards or whatever. Just, there's no need to drop it in the fastest current right on some riffraff.
Perfect. Good. Well, I'm glad you hit on those. Those are awesome tips, some safety to be thinking about. So let's do a couple of quick ones on Helena. So we're coming through there, fish in Missouri, like you said, maybe coming through in the spring, maybe early summer. What's a restaurant we might be after a fishing day on the water that we could swing in and get some food in Helena?
I'll give you a couple options. We'll kind of start with some, maybe a couple cheaper ones. There's the Grub Steak right on the edge of town in the North Valley. That's kind of a good place, that just, you think Western type bar restaurant. That's a good one. And then right in town, you have the Windbag is on the walking mall. The walking mall, Helena downtown, is pretty cool looking, just town area. And so I would recommend just checking out that area. Pretty cool. A lot of people like the Windbag. It's got a cool atmosphere to it. Then stepping up a little bit more, is I really like the on Broadway depending on where you're coming from, like I have some buddies that live in Texas, and I told them to go there one time when they were here, and I told them, I was like, hey, it's going to be a little bit pricey, and they called me after they left, and they're like, dude, that was, like, amazing, and it was actually cheap, and so.
All right.
Yeah. For Helena, it's pricey, but if you're coming from Austin or New York or wherever, sure. Then, it's going to be cheaper for you, but that's a really cool place. It's been around for a long time. Luca's is a really good Italian restaurant downtown on that same thing, right on that walking mall stretch that I mentioned. And then really cool hole in the wall. Like if you're staying in Helena and you want to drive outside of town and just go to two really cool places, have really good bar food. One's going to be called the Marysville House. Check the hours when you're gone, because they're only open like Wednesday through Sunday, and then, or maybe even Thursday through Sunday, depending on the time of year. That's kind of at the base of our ski hill, and that's a really cool place. But the Marysville House is one, and then also the York Bar. Get the burger. Don't get the double, because that's like a pot. That's a pound of burger meat. And then get the onion rings.
Oh, onion rings. Good. Okay. Awesome. This is perfect. So, and then what about a local beverage? What's your beverage of choice if you're out there after a day on the water?
We have some great breweries in Helena. We have Lewis and Clark Brewery, which is kind of nationally famous now. They have a lot of good brews there.
Is that the Moosterl one? Is that Moosterl?
No, I think that's the Big Sky out of Missoula.
Oh, that's Big Sky.
Prickly Pear is really popular from there. And then I think it's called, I actually don't drink anymore. So.
Oh, you don't? There you go.
No.
I was going to ask you, what are your, we had a listener recently come back and say, man, I love, you know, that question where you ask, what are people's vices? You know, like, what do you tie on a vice? But also, what are the vices, the kind of the personally things you had to quit? And I think alcohol for a lot of us is one of those things that, you know, I always say, like, you do it in moderation and it seems like you're good for a while, but eventually a lot of the stuff you have to quit as you get older, right?
Yeah, I've been sober for 11 and a half years.
Amazing.
It was funny, our first conversation, we kind of touched on a little bit of my history and just a little bit in that first podcast, and I was like, oh man, I was a troublemaker when I was a kid, and you asked me, you're like, oh, what's one of the worst things you did? And I was like, man, there's a lot of them, and I kind of skirted the issue, and it's like, I've been arrested a few times in my life.
There you go. So. That, you know, you're not the first person on this podcast who's been arrested, you know, admitted that. That's like, you know, the way I look at it is that, man, we all make mistakes. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
totally.
Especially, and it's scary too. You have a kid. I mean, I think your kid might be a little bit older than mine, but my girls are, you know, 9 and 11, and they're at that age where I'm like, man, I'm really worried because there's a lot of scary things. You know what I mean? Like just driving with her friends when she starts driving in the car is scary.
Yeah, my daughter's 8.
Oh, 8. Oh, yeah, we're right in the same range. Perfect.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you start to, I think they're at the age now where when they were real young, you didn't remember being that old. But now I'm like, I can distinctly remember what I was doing when I was 8 and 9 and 10 and whatever. And so that's when it starts to get when I'm like, man. Like 5 years from now, I'm going to be screwed.
I know.
Just, you start to think about that whole
the
thing.
The stuff you did at that age. I know. Gosh.
Yeah.
Right on. Cool, Justin. Well, this has been awesome. I think it's been good to catch up with you here. Obviously, Helena is a place that we're going to hopefully get to and spend some time here in this next year. So, yeah, man, I'd love to get in one of your boats too, man. I'll give you a call when we get out that way and hopefully we can float one of these rivers.
Yeah, definitely love to get out with you, and you guys check out Helena. It's the Capitol here too, so the Capitol building is really cool to see. Check that out, and then just kind of there's a ton of stuff to do around the town. It's picked up in the last handful of years. The Blackfoot Brewery's here too. That's a cool little place to see. And so it's definitely a up and coming scene, but it's a great family town. Like, it doesn't have that college vibe. It's got more of, like, I would say our vibe, where we got younger kids growing up. There's sports. There's good kids activities. It's there is some nightlife. But for the most part, if you're in Helena, you probably like the outdoors.
Cool, Justin. Well, I got to get rolling. So I'll be in touch. I'll let you know when this one gets ready to roll. And, appreciate all your time today and for putting this one together.
Definitely, man. Thank you.
Another one that flew by. I can't wait to get on the water and in that Adipose boat and enjoy that drink on the water or the big day. You can send me an email, dave@wetflyswing.com. If you are interested in hearing more about some of the trips we have going around the country, and you can also find out from what we have going with our school events and giveaways, wetflyswing.com/giveaway. You can find out if we have anything going right now. And like I said, give me an email and check back, and I will let you know what we have going. Okay, lots going on, so I'm going to keep this one short and sweet, this outro, and just want to give you one call to action before you get out of here. If you haven't followed this show on Apple Podcast or on Spotify, you can do that right now. This is the best way to make sure that next episode gets delivered right into your inbox. And also, it's the best way to keep in touch with us. So subscribe, follow us on Apple Podcasts or whatever app you're using now. I know the Google app, if you're on Google Podcasts, if you're listening, that is going away. And I think they're changing things up a little bit. So my recommendation, if you are on Android, would be Spotify. I believe they still, I think they have a free version. I could be wrong on that now, but I do love Spotify, especially for the music tips. And anyways, I'm going to get out of here and enough chitter chatter. I hope you're having a good morning, a good afternoon, or a good evening, wherever in the world you are. And I appreciate you for stopping in today. And I look forward to seeing you on that next episode.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com.